One of the points that came again and again was, I wish I had told somebody something that I didn't get a chance to tell them. But also what came up a little more subtly maybe was, I didn't realize what so-and-so did for me or meant to me or gave to me or how they influenced me until after they were gone. And so it's sometimes about regret, but it's also like a freeing thing in a way, recognizing I didn't know what I didn't know.
Kim Langley is president of Life Balance Enterprises and founder of Word Spa, that's Word S-P-A, for Spirituality, Poetry, Appreciation, an organization that engages poetry as a healing art. I talked today with Kim about her book, Send My Roots Rain, A Companion on the Grief Journey, about how poetry helps us grapple with multiple aspects of grief and find purpose, beauty, and joy, even amid devastating circumstances. I'm Matthew Wickman, founding director of the BYU Humanities Center. Kim Langley, it's great to see you here over Zoom, and you're so good to come in and talk with me today. Thank you.
My pleasure.
You know, I usually open by asking my guests whether and how their faith impacts their life and work. And in your case, you're a spiritual director. And I'm wondering whether that vocation is related to traditional faith expressed through a particular religious tradition, or whether your journey's different from that.
It's been a wonderful journey. I was raised in a very seriously practicing Catholic family, and I'm very grateful for the excellent Catholic education I had and the foundation in morals and so on. And I raised my kids in that church. And then eventually I felt called to something that was more inclusive. And so I was and am a member of the Episcopal Church. But I will admit freely that my deepest encounters with God happen not so much in the building, but in the garden and in groups that I have the privilege of facilitating. And I've been in a spiritual direction group of 8 women who are a powerhouse for over almost 30 years now. And they have deeply, deeply shaped who I am. So it's been I've had a couple amazing spiritual directors, and so through the providence of God, here I am.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, you know, your sensitivity to spiritual things is very evident in this wonderful book you've written about grief, titled "Send My Roots Rain." And in reading it, I was really struck by the poems that you chose as what you call companions for readers, right, on their grief journeys. And I was also struck by the empathy you demonstrate for those undergoing the grieving process. Now, this is a book, Kim, that's filled with compassion, and for that reason, perhaps necessarily, seems born of its own experience of grief. And I'm wondering, was personal grief the impetus for the book, or was the book inspired by some other set of circumstances?
It's a great question, Matt, and the answer is both. I'm at the both and stage of my life, not so
sure.
much the either or stage
sure,
of my
good.
Life.
Those are good stages.
Right?
Yeah.
And so I had a very loving family, but like many families, they put the fun in dysfunctional. And so a lot of my career has been what's kind of thinly veiled mental health education. So even the work I've done in corporations has been around conflict management and dealing with difficult people and managing difficult conversations and building a respectful workplace and blah, blah, blah. And so I hope you don't spend your life reading about and improving your workshops and teaching that unless you're willing to do some work on yourself, you know? So I am not unacquainted with grief. From some family of origin issues. And then I grew up with a single parent because my dad was alcoholic. He did eventually recover, but my mom probably wisely raised me without his influence when I was young. And so, you know, there were losses even early in life. And then when I became a spiritual director, you know, I noticed how often people were coming because they had lost somebody and it shook up their world. And, you know, they had questions now about God and God's will and you know, it was, you know, it was complicated. And so, of course, I'm reading and working with my own spiritual director. So, yes. And then very ironically, I was apparently preparing through the whole 4-year writing process for the death of my own parents, who, when I accepted the contract to write this book, were, you know, like 80-ish, but they were doing well. And then they went into a period of decline. And the month before the manuscript was due, the final manuscript was due, they both passed away a month and a day apart from each other. So,
wow.
So that was something.
Absolutely.
And yeah. So, yeah.
So there we, okay. You know, I was close to grandparents, all four of them, huge blessing, and they all passed away. You know, I'm old enough now that they're not here with us any longer. And that's grief I've had, and I've had friends, close friends pass away. I was most touched though by when I was 7 years old, my 5-year-old brother passed away. And that's left. And you know, at that stage of life, you're not grieving in the way that you would as an adult, but it informs your entire perspective onto the world. So grief in various ways has been a part of my life, like it has so many lives for most of my life. Yes. And that's why the topic that you've chosen to write on, I'm really just inherently drawn to. And the way you get at this is really wonderful. In fact, I want to talk a bit about the structure and a few core principles of your book. It has a very clear structure, your book does. There's 4 parts to the book, 15 poems in each part. You have commentary and key quotes that follow the poems. And then at the end of the sections, the 4 sections, there are some mindfulness activities. And it's really, it's a book meant to sort of dwell with more than just to read through. And when I was looking at it, I mean, it just seemed very intuitive and really nicely put together. I thought I'd ask you here for our listeners, why write about grief by way of poetry? Why not grief and philosophy, or grief and sacred texts from religious traditions, or grief and memoir and so on?
So that's a terrific question. This is so much fun. Well, for one thing, poetry is my wheelhouse, you know, so even though I made my living as a speaker and trainer, and you're not using poems generally with corporate audiences, in retreat work, which I've always kept my hand in, even when I was mostly on the other side, you know, making a living to put kids through college and so on, poetry is extremely evocative for getting past the polite and into the deeper dive, you know, and I don't know, you know how people have certain yearnings that from a young age, I was so blessed when I look back now. My mom was not a reader. She was like second in her class, but she didn't get to go to college because those were the days, you know?
Yeah.
And yet she was absolutely determined that I would be a reader and I would go to college. Now, where did that come from? Like, how did she have that vision? You know, I just am so grateful for that. And so she was an executive secretary, which was a big thing in those days because, you know, she worked for all these vice presidents for a steel company and so on, but she made a secretary salary because, you know, patriarchy. And she would spend part of her paycheck every 2 weeks on books for me because she couldn't drive and we couldn't go to the library. So from a really early age, I had this love of language and I was reading stuff like, you know, The Black Arrow, which is a classic with all this, I think it's Scottish dialect in it and so on. I mean, I just loved it. And then, of course, you'll be shocked to hear that I'm a big fan of J.R.R. Tolkien.
Yeah, right.
And his musical writing. And then when I was maybe 11, or no, I looked it up, but maybe I was even younger than that. Anyway, Aunt Viola Bueller, the maiden aunt who was, I say that in air quotes for our listeners, the maiden aunt who was a big influence in my life, she gave me Louis Untermeyer's Golden Treasury of Poetry for Children.
Nice. Yeah.
Boing.
Yeah, that's a great gift.
Nothing was ever the same. I memorized things like Annabelle Lee and The Raven. And yeah. I mean, you name it. I memorized tons of poems and they weren't, this is really snotty, so get ready. They weren't sissy poems. They were like poems with big vocabulary in them that kids couldn't possibly know and that you had to look up in the dictionary, but they were beautifully selected.
Lovely.
As if the kid reading them would have a brain, you know, and so And I say that with no shade thrown on poets who are writing modern poets that are appropriate for children's reading level. I get that, you know, and I affirm that. But anyway, that's how it happened. That's okay. Where the bug bit me. And then after that, you know, I just would read poetry for joy. I don't know how else to say it.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's going to be a joy for me to talk poetry with you here in just a few minutes. I want to go over a few poems in this book and have us talk about them together because they're gorgeous. Okay. These, I mean, you have great. I mean, I was so struck by the great judgment you showed and the poems you selected. It really struck.
Thank you.
Before we
well,
get
you know,
there,
that was the yeah. bones. I mean, it took over a year. I had a contract to write the book in a year.
Mm. Yeah, right.
Okay. It took a whole year just to vet the poems. And I mean, not a word of the book was written. It took a whole year. I looked at I'm not exaggerating. I bet I looked at 1,000 poems before I picked these. And I had help, a friend who's a chaplain at the Cleveland Clinic and a friend who's a retired social worker with some certifications in grief work, met with me over and over and over. And I would collect the poems and then they would give them an A or a B or a no-go.
Okay.
And that took a year. But once we had the poems, then that's where the structure came from. So I am coming back to your question, like,
yeah,
okay, now
right.
How do we get our arms around this mass of amazing poems, each of which is chosen to represent, to create a springboard for discussion for some aspect of grief?
That's right. I should mention
grief or disenfranchised grief. Good. Or the grief of our child or a partner or a sibling. That's how it happened.
Okay. I should mention the book's four parts, right, for our listeners.
Oh, please do. Yeah, I'm sorry.
No. Because I thought, the way you label them are themselves, you know, is yourself evocative. Four parts. Part one, dusk and twilight. Part two, sunset. Part three, midnight. And part four, starlight to dawn. So it's imagined, it's a book about, you know, a journey, a grief
yes.
journey. And the parts suggest that kind of journey over the course of a day, really, and night, leading back into day. Can you explain what the four parts mean? Dusk and twilight,
well,
sunset, midnight, and starlight to dawn.
Yes, that was a part of a pretty long and prayerful discernment because there were other models for how to unfold the journey, you know. But this is the one that I finally settled on because, first of all, you're trying to write a really inclusive book that, I mean, I'm deeply rooted in the Christian tradition. And I also wanted people who were rooted in some other spiritual tradition to find comfort in this book too. And I really had, you know, chaplains and funeral directors and hospice workers in mind because I have a background in ministry, you know, my master's degree in religious education. Who do I hang out with? You know, my friends are all therapists and drug and alcohol counselors and spiritual directors and chaplains. And so how to arrange this material in a way where a person who wants to use it, not only personally, but professionally with a patient that they're visiting or somebody who leads a grief group or is putting together a celebration of life service. And this is what I finally settled on because the hope for me, the prayer over and over, and believe me, this was one of the spiritual experiences of my life, living with this book for 4 years and trying to create something that would go out and do good work, you know. The hope is that in every life, something terrible things are going to happen. It's just the way it is, you know. One of the poems in here by Gregory Orr, who, by the way, Matt, his brother died when he was a young boy.
Oh.
Yeah. He was out hunting with his father, and he accidentally shot his brother.
That's such
Can
a moving.
Imagine?
No, you mentioned that story in your commentary on that poem, and it's just devastating.
So, it really is. And he, you know, obviously, like you said, it impacted his whole life. And this is Gregory Orr, O-R-R, for your listeners. And he wrote a poem called Grief Will Come to You. And like the simplicity of that statement, that first line, grief will come to you. And it's like, struggle all you want, you know, stuff's going to happen. And then the end of the poem, it's just very short, is all you can do is keep swimming. All you can do is keep singing. Mm. And that moved me so much that that's part of how we came up with this arc. That grief will come to you, and sometimes you can anticipate it, and sometimes it's a brick in the head, you know. And then you go through, I don't use the word stages very deliberately because, you know, even poor Elizabeth Kubler-Ross said, they're not stages.
Yeah.
And they were meant for the dying, not the grieving.
Right.
But
great point.
Right. But Warden, W-O-R-D-E-N, talks about tasks of mourning, which I think is more useful. And so if you move through the tasks of mourning to the place where you can not get over it, not resolve it, not heal from it. The language was very challenging. But what I finally hit on, others have before me, of course, was you learn to carry it. You learn to carry it. And so, you know, that kind of dawn is as you realize, I'm learning to carry this. You know, I'm still alive. I still have things to do. My loved one would want me to have a life. And now I have to figure out, you know, how to do that with some joy and some gratitude. That's one of the reasons I made Otherwise by Jane Kenyon, one of the last poems in the book. That was one of the ones you
I want to get to that poem if we can, in a little bit. I really do. That's a beautiful poem. Let me just pick up on something you just said, right? You learn to carry it. You learn to carry it. You know, that you quote here, and tell me if I pronounce the name correctly, someone, Rachel Naomi Remen. Is that how you say it?
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Remen.
And she observes something that I find really provocative. She says this, I'm quoting, and you quote her, perhaps real wisdom lies in not seeking answers at all. Any answer we find will not be true for long. An answer is a place where we can fall asleep as life moves past us to its next question. After all these years, I've begun to wonder if the secret of living well is not in having all the answers, but in pursuing unanswerable questions in good company,
right?
Learning to carry these things, right?
Yes.
Now, you are a spiritual director. I'm curious how people who talk with you take to that kind of idea. Do they come to you looking for companionship in the journey, or do they come seeking concrete answers?
Both. But, you know, spiritual director is sort of the old-fashioned word for what we do, and the programs that train us are still called spiritual direction programs. But a lot of us refer to ourselves more commonly as spiritual companions.
Okay.
And a whole community has adopted the language of Anamkara, which I'm sure some of your readers are familiar with, and that's an Irish term for a soul friend, and Anamkara is a soul friend. And so what happens for me a lot of times is, I'll lead a poetry circle or I'll give a retreat. And for lack of a better description, people just kind of smell that I could be a soul friend to them, you know? And so they'll approach me very tentatively. Do you see people individually? You know, I'm going through some stuff. And it's fascinating because sometimes they're really mad, you know, they're mad at God. One of the first questions I often have to ask is, who is the God you're mad at? You know, you have to get early on their idea of God. What were they brought up with? And so many people were brought up with an idea of God that's, you know, how do I say this? Like, well, what the research shows, let's fall back on research, because I really do like, I didn't mention that, but in addition to reading 100,000 books about grief, I was also trying to read the research on poetry therapy and writing therapy for people who are grieving. And that's part of the reason why I have mindfulness activities in there, you know, to maybe spur some journaling or whatever, because the research is pretty compelling that's very helpful for people. So sometimes they want to know, you know, how could God have put Jonah in the belly of a whale? How could God have turned, you know, and then you wind up doing biblical exegesis, you know, exploring with them what that might mean. You know, is it literal? Is it symbolic? How can we understand it? And then the other thing is that people just say, why did this happen to me?
Yeah, that's the big
and
one,
then,
isn't it?
Right, it is, of course. And we all feel that way sometimes. Even I, who don't think of that as a particularly helpful question, will fall into it sometimes.
Sure.
But then you need to really enlarge. A lot of this book, and for me, spiritually writing it, was about enlarging, enlarging, enlarging. There's a quote in here by Mark Nepo that goes something like, you know, when something big happens to you, it's usually a call to growth. Stop being a glass, become a lake.
Yeah, right.
You know, and that's what a spiritual companion does. It helps just hold your hand while you transition from being a puddle, which is often how we feel when the caca has hit the fan, to being a lake, you know?
Yeah. Okay.
As best we can, since we're not lakes ourselves all the time.
No. But I mean, you know, that kind of, look, companionship generally, right, tends to sort of deepen most of us, right? We sure. we recognize in that kind of setting that we know things that we don't always understand that we know or realize that we know.
Yes.
May I turn to some poems here? I thought it'd be kind of fun for us to talk about some of the poems in this book.
And what this I'll is do, a three-hour interview right now.
Yeah, I wish. It could be. It could be, Kim, because the subject matter justifies it, you know. First of all, I pared down to five, and if we have time to talk about all five, we will, but getting to five was excruciating.
I bet.
I was taking stock of, how many poems here we met about? I began like 40, and that's not going to work. And we're talking like an 18-hour interview. So, I mean, what I do
all
week
here. And now
you
can feel my pain that first year.
Oh,
can
seriously?
You imagine?
Yeah, no, I know.
It was like, which of your kids do you like the best?
I know.
Which is, of course, a bad question.
Or which blade of grass in your lawn is your favorite? Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, good luck, right?
Yeah.
So what I thought I'd do, let me read a couple poems here, and you can tell me,
do.
If you would, why you chose the poem from the book and what you take from it. All right?
Yes.
I'll begin here with a poem by Jane Kenyon called Let Evening Come. Here it is. Let the light of late afternoon shine through chinks in the barn, moving up the bales as the sun moves down. Let the cricket take up chafing as a woman takes up her needles and her yarn. Let evening come. Let dew collect on the hoe abandoned in the long grass. Let the stars appear and the moon disclose her silver horn. Let the fox go back to its sandy den. Let the wind die down. Let the shed go black inside. Let evening come. To the bottle in the ditch, to the scoop in the oats, to the air in the lung, let evening come. Let it come as it will, and don't be afraid. God does not leave us comfortless, so let evening come.
Ugh.
Beautiful.
I can never hear that poem without being deeply moved. You know, Jane Kenyon, I'm a firm believer that once the poem leaves the poet, it's ours, and we don't have to know the life of the poem. And I definitely don't think our job is to say, what does the poem mean?
Yeah, sure.
You know,
sure.
Rather, what comes up in us. But it helps me to know that she suffered from depression sometimes, and she had a cancer diagnosis. A lot of her poetry was published by her husband, also a poet, after she died. And so to know that she was in the midst of struggle when she wrote this is so moving to me, you know. And it's the images are so everyday, you know, a little bit of knitting as a woman takes up her needles. That strong image of late afternoon sun shining through chinks in the barn, moving up the bales as the sun moves down.
Beautiful.
So, you know, she was sitting there quietly contemplating or meditating or just being for quite a while to be able to watch that sun go up and down. So the poem, it's an invitation to be still. I would say, you know, for religious people, it's an invitation to be still and know, you know, God. What drew you about it, Matt? I'm a facilitator, so
yeah,
you know,
sure.
I don't want to just talk about it myself.
No, a couple things did. The refrain, let evening come, you know, which it repeats several times. I find that really remarkable because it's the kind of thing that you say in a state of quietness.
Yes.
But there's also something that requires resolution about it.
Yes,
you know, it's you know, you're in late afternoon, you know, as the sun is falling, it's not yet evening. Let it come. Let evening come. And it requires a kind of a courage. It's about stillness, but also strength. And
those
right? So sensitivity, but also resolution. I found that really beautiful about it. And then at the end, kind of the note of hopefulness. God does not leave us comfortless. So let evening come.
Right.
As though there, I mean, the companionship here is with a reader. The companionship is with the things that are around her, but the companionship also evocatively is the companionship of God amid this experience of anticipatory grief.
Yes. And it's all one for her. You know, the scoop in the oats,
The
air in the lung. You know, she makes it clear that it isn't just beautiful things like the sun moving up over the bale. It's everything in which God does not leave us comfortless.
Yeah.
And this poem, well, I've loved this poem for a long time, long before I had the contract to write this book. But I when you publish a book, people want you to sign it. And these are grieving, really vulnerable people. It can't be the wrong thing. So I prayed and prayed and prayed. What do I put when I sign a book? And when I finally came to something, in every book I sign, I write, "May you find comfort in unexpected places." Because I feel like that's one way that God, whether you even know God or not, or however you define God, you know, the God of your understanding, God does not leave us comfortless, because if you're paying attention, if you're listening, you will find comfort in unexpected places, and they will be golden moments even when things are the worst.
Yeah, nice. That's beautiful. Thank you. Let's turn to another poem here.
Sure.
This is titled "Those Winter Sundays" by Robert Hayden. It's page 82 in your book, and it's
a knockout.
It is, and it's haunting. Do you want to read this one?
Oh, I would love to.
Okay.
Thank you. "Those Winter Sundays." Sundays too, my father got up early and put his clothes on in the blue, black cold. Then with cracked hands that ached from labor in the weekday weather, made banked fires blaze. No one ever thanked him. I'd wake and hear the cold splintering, breaking. When the rooms were warm, he'd call, and slowly I would rise and dress, fearing the chronic angers of that house, speaking indifferently to him who had driven out the cold and polished my good shoes as well. What did I know? What did I know of love's austere and lonely offices?
Yeah. Wow. Tell me about this poem. Well, I mean, it's beautiful, and I do find it to be a haunting poem. What drew you to it? Why'd you include it in the book?
Well, part of the, you know, the like craft and ministry of the book was interviewing 40 some people who were counselors and individual grievers and chaplains and so on, and asking them, you know, what's the one thing you think should be in a grief book that would help people the most, or what would have helped you the most? And I always wrote that down. And then from that, I made a list of themes to cover. And then I chose poems to cover those points. And so one of the points that came again and again was, I wish I had told somebody something that I didn't get a chance to tell them. But also what came up a little more subtly maybe was, I didn't realize what so-and-so did for me or meant to me or gave to me or how they influenced me until after they were gone. And so it's sometimes about regret, but it's also like a freeing thing in a way, recognizing I didn't know what I didn't know. And isn't that just entirely the human condition? You know, we're all walking around. We don't know what we don't know. It's one of the reasons we can't get along with people who don't think the same way we do or vote the same way we do, et cetera, et cetera. We don't know what we don't know. And so that refrain, well, first of all, the craft of the poem is
absolutely
amazing wordsmithing and vulnerable, so vulnerable, right? And grateful. It's the perfect mixture of regret and gratitude wordsmithed into just 14 lines, I think. And then that last two lines, what did I know? What did I know of love's austere, what a word choice, and lonely offices? So it gets beyond all that kind of, you know, I'm going to be a brat now and say, American emphasis on let's be happy and let's be fulfilled and let's, you know, feel happy all the time, or let's feel love all the time. Let's find our soulmates. And it gets down to the sweaty, nitty gritty every day of love, which if you're a parent or a spouse, or if you've ever taken care of an elder, has plenty of austere and very lonely offices that no one knows about but you. And yet it's love, love, love with a capital L.
Yeah, love expressed through perspiration and strain. Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah. You know, my wife is a therapist. And for a few years, she was a social worker in a hospice company, and she worked with clients facing end-of-life diagnoses and also with their grieving family members. And she'd often talk about unfinished business. This is, you know, things that unsaid that need to be expressed, or things people need to forgive, you know, thank you and I love you and so on. And you point out in your commentary on the poem, right, that the poem expresses this kind of belated appreciation for the father, but through a kind of hurt, right? That loneliness and austerity is implicitly also the poet's as a younger man, right? That's what he felt in the home rather than the love that was being expressed through it. And you remark in your commentary that part of reconciling ourselves to our past is coming to recognize behaviors in others that were the product not only of character or choices they made, but also their circumstances, their upbringings, their unresolved traumas, and so forth. How do you work with people who come to you to help them through things like this that are difficult to reconcile?
Well, as a spiritual director, you know, and I am a certified pastoral counselor too, one of the first things you learn is when you're in over your head and it's really a therapeutic moment and not an anamkara moment. So the first thing I would say responsibly is you know when to refer.
Great.
You know, right?
Yes, absolutely.
And some, not everybody does, and that can be not good. So I'm always willing to companion someone who has trauma and is still very much suffering from it. Like maybe this is their first run at that trauma, you know, working with me. And I'll stay in an anamkara relationship with them if they will go to counseling also. So I won't keep working with someone who's trying to use me as a counselor when what they really need is a trauma specialist. So that's the short answer.
Okay.
The long answer, I guess, is that when people are doing their work, you know, they're taking appropriate measures for mental health measures, then it's a joy and a privilege to accompany people as things are unfolding for them psychologically to be able to say, and how do you integrate this into your life? And where was God in that, if they're a God person? Or where was the more or the divine? Or how did that enlarge your spirit? You know, you have to use the language that the person uses. And boy, those are moments, you know. I mean, I'm constantly humbled and amazed. I'm sure your wife has expressed this too, at how people will let you into their lives, you know, and say true things that are so painful and let you move with them from point A to point B. Is there any more satisfying work? You experience some of that in a workshop. That's probably why I became a teacher and so on. But you really experience it exponentially when you work with people in a very small group or one-on-one.
Absolutely.
I mean, you're just a conduit in my belief. Not everyone uses language, but in my belief, you know, I always pray before I teach. I always pray before I coach or do spiritual direction. I think that the goal is just to be, try and set your own ego aside as best you can and let yourself be a conduit for love, capital L love. So I always think of God as love when I'm in these situations, not so much as father or mother, or not even so much the biblical God, although I'm attracted to all those things, but what's the next thing that love requires here when I'm trying to be present to this person's unfolding?
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
What's the next thing that love requires? And sometimes that's just to sit for a minute. I'll say to somebody, I just need to think about what you said for a minute. Just give me a minute.
Yeah. Which I'm sure they take
well.
And I
wait for the movement, you know?
Yeah. It's a sign of respect for what they're saying, right? That you don't, you don't come with the answers already preformed, right? That they are unique individuals and you respond uniquely, and that requires sitting. All right, and requires reflecting.
I mean, I love to have answers, and I love to refer people to books that have helped me. And I love to come up with a poem that speaks to what they just accepted. But the bottom line is they're their own best spiritual director in many ways, and you're just along for the ride.
Yeah. Okay, speaking of rides,
yes.
The next poem takes place on a train platform, set on a train platform. It's poem Stillbirth by, I hope I pronounce this correctly, Lauren.
I'm not positive myself.
So Laure-Anne Lauren Bosselaar. And yes. I find this poem really, again, beautiful and, you know, sort of technically really very accomplished, but haunting also. I'll read this one. On a platform, I heard someone call out your name. No, Letitia, no. It wasn't my train. The doors were closing, but I rushed in searching for your face. But no, Letitia, no. No one in that car could have been you, but I rushed in, searching for your face. No longer an infant, a woman now, blonde, 32. No one in that car could have been you. Letitia Marie was the name I had chosen. No longer an infant, a woman now, blonde, 32. I sometimes go months without remembering you. Letitia Marie was the name I had chosen. I was told not to look, not to get attached. I sometimes go months without remembering you. Some griefs bless us that way, not asking much space. I was told not to look, not to get attached. It wasn't my train. The doors were closing. Some griefs bless us that way, not asking much space. On a platform, I heard someone calling your name. It's such an amazing poem, the way it loops around on these phrases, you know, and breaks up the punctuation. So the phrase, it's the same, or virtually the same use the same sequence of words, but used differently and accentuated differently. It really does suggest someone who comes around and turns around on these thoughts almost. Yes. So that clearly the poem is enacting a kind of a memory. But also enacting almost a kind of an obsession, like a memory that you want to hold and cannot let go. Both things are true, right? Yes. Which is indicative of a certain kind of grief. I want to hold it, but even if I wanted to let it go, I couldn't.
Yes.
And that is what I find just remarkable about this poem.
Well, and that's one of the tasks of mourning too, is not to like let it go. I mean, if you love that person, even though this is about a stillbirth, obviously that's the title, but you love your child even before it's born, most people. And it's okay. I would say this poem perfectly captures the tone and the process of figuring out what's my continuing relationship with this person who is gone. But she's not figured it out yet quite. She hasn't quite yet learned how to carry it in some ways. In other ways, she has learned how to carry it. It's a poem written about a space in grief that doesn't get written about much. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
that's one of the reasons I picked it.
Yeah. No,
it's that no longer not yet space of grief, which is exquisitely painful, and which you won't give up because you love that person and you don't want to put them behind you. You don't want to heal from that loss because you still love them and you have a continuing relationship with them.
That's right.
And so she keeps emphasizing 32 years old. And what a comfort to any parent who's ever lost a child to know that it's perfectly normal 32 years later to still feel sad on that child's birthday or when you hear that name. And we assume, I wrote in the comments that we assume this is a mother speaking because the poet is a female and, you know, I was told not to look. But it could just as easily be the perspective of a father. Fathers are very overlooked in miscarriages and stillbirth. All the attention is on the mother. But that's also the father's child who they both had dreams for that child. They had a future mapped out in their heads for that child. And the future was nothing like what they expected because it was a stillbirth, you know?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So it's anyway, the no longer. I agree. Yeah. It's a marvelous poem and you've read it really well. No, Letitia, no. And then the next time, no, Letitia, no.
Yeah. When I first saw that, I thought, wow. Yeah, it was my first response to that poem and the technical mastery of it and how it communicated, you know, both you know, both the sense of loss, but also the loss of an imagined future. And this is right. What makes that so?
She would be adult now. She would blonde. She would be 32. And you know, the grief specialists tell us that that happens in every event. So, you know, your older child marries, and you think about your younger child who died, who will never marry. And then your older child has a baby, and then you are joyful, and you also think about your younger child who did not live to have a baby. And that's part of why I think learning to carry it is the right words in many ways for what grief is.
Absolutely. I this is not my child, but my brother. You know, I'm now 54. He'd be 52. And I've thought, you know, as I've turned, you know, 32, he'd be 30.
Yes.
You know, 42, he'd be 40. When I got married, you know, would he be married? I had children, would he? It does, these things do stay with you. And in some ways it's grieving, it's sad. In other ways it's because it stays with you, it's almost a source of comfort. This person may have passed, but never fully left my life, my thought.
Exactly. There's a continuing bond there.
That's
He's still your brother.
That's right.
He'll always be your brother. You know, and if you believe in an afterlife, which of course not everybody does, but if you do, you know, you can talk to them.
That's right. Yeah, I very much do. And that's another. If this were that kind of interview, we'd have that conversation. But that's a great point you make, Kim. You know, this really should be a 4-hour interview, and it can't be. But let me.
Well, maybe another time.
Yes. No. Seriously,
we can take up the other 36 poems that you had to eliminate.
Exactly right. Seriously.
Before you chose the 4.
But I do want to go to one that you mentioned early. It's Jane Kenyon again. It's that poem, Otherwise.
Yes.
Which is on page 146 of your book. I wonder if you would read that, and then we'll make this the last of the poems we go over, and then a couple more questions I'll have for you after this. But let's talk about Otherwise. If that's okay.
Yes. Okay. Otherwise, I got out of bed on 2 strong legs. It might have been otherwise. I ate cereal, sweet milk, ripe, flawless peach. It might have been otherwise. I took the dog uphill to the birch wood. All morning, I did the work I love. At noon, I lay down with my mate. It might have been otherwise. We ate dinner together at a table with silver candlesticks. It might have been otherwise. I slept in a bed in a room with paintings on the walls and planned another day just like this day. But one day, I know, it will be otherwise.
Again with her, you know, that last poem we read of hers, Let Evening Come, with refrain. Now, you know, it might have been otherwise. And of course, the variation at the end, one day I know it will be otherwise.
Yes.
Very poignant.
Yes. And, you know, part of what kept me going on this book, because there were times when I said to myself, was I out of my mind to say that I would do this? There were friends who had to talk me off the ledge, believe me. Part of what kept me going was that I really believe in my heart of hearts that if we think about death in healthy ways, and frequently even, I would say, and I know that will disturb some, it's such a powerful backdrop for life. The denial of death that many people in our culture practice is so harmful, because not only do people not know how to grieve when they have a loss, which is inevitable, but they miss that rich point of comparison that it might be otherwise. So knowing that it could be otherwise enhances every pleasure of the moment, you know, and it gives that most precious of things perspective, you know. So
When your kids
are behaving well and you're feeling very fond of them and they're sleeping and they're beautiful angels, knowing that it can be otherwise is part of what makes that so precious, right?
Yeah, for sure.
As your parent is aging and they're driving you crazy because they keep asking you if you want to put a sweater on because they're cold. Mm-hmm. It gives you that perspective to say, well, I'd rather have this than not have them here at all.
That's or, right.
You know, this is the woman who made me the reader I am, or this is the woman who made sure I got the college on a secretary salary, or what, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
Perspective is everything.
It
keeps you from being a navel gazer.
Okay, so let me ask you on that score. You know, you mentioned that we don't live in our culture with much vivid awareness of our own mortality. We kind of defer it, we avoid it, we deny it. And it's one thing to live with prospects of our own mortality in mind. And philosophers write, you know, Heidegger, Kierkegaard write about, you know, the importance of being unto death, et cetera. But it's something else, it seems to me, to live with prospects of the mortality of those we love, right?
Yes.
Things may be beautiful now, but one day we know, perhaps one day soon, they will be otherwise. And I'm wondering how you counsel people who are living with those prospects vividly in mind, who have partners or children or parents, or where they know that the time is short.
Well, I do a lot of teaching about resilience that's evidence-based and data-driven. And the research shows that a strong gratitude practice is an enormous asset when a person needs to be resilient. And so I often try to help people find what are they grateful for. You know, not every relationship is beautiful. Not every parent is nurturing. Not every death is peaceful. You know, I sometimes work with people whose parents are just going, they do not go gentle into that good night.
Yeah.
You know, and that's its own kind of pain. And not but, and there's often something that one can be grateful for. So maybe it's even, my dad was an alcoholic, and so that I learned early about alcoholism and how it can wreck your life, and therefore I was able to avoid that pitfall myself. There were other pitfalls, but he was a great teacher of, and he'd be the first to admit it, of what not to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm grateful for that,
yeah.
Really grateful for that. And then when my own dad went into recovery, he and I was young and like going through all the angst 20s, you know, and by that time I knew him. And so he said to me one time, I was saying, I don't know what to do about this. I don't know what to do about that. And he said, I don't know either, but I can tell you this. Everything I ever handed over to God had claw marks on it.
Yeah. That's a remarkable saying. Yeah.
Right.
Uh-huh.
So even though when he died, I was deeply sad that I would never have the relationship that anybody might want with their biological father, because now he's dead and all the chances are over, I still had those moments to say, you know, thank you for. So I think gratitude would be my first answer. If we had more time, we could, of course, unpack this at great length. But
okay.
When people are really suffering, there's one poem in here that I really love.
Which one is that?
I'm sure you noticed it. Well, I'm trying to flip through quickly and find it. But the gist of it is, you know, what would you do if you knew that you were the last person that somebody was going to see? Do you remember that one?
Yeah. I don't.
And I think it's by Ellen Bass, who has quickly become one of my favorite poets. And the gist of it is that she goes to lunch with her great aunt, with her powdery face and her wrinkled, you know, so on. And the waiter calls her aunt honey and kisses her on the cheek before she leaves. And they walk down the street and the aunt has like a massive stroke or heart attack or something and drops dead on the sidewalk. So literally, one of the last people she sees is this waiter, and he treated her with perfect respect and love and compassion. And, you know, there must have been a connection there, and most waiters aren't going to kiss you on the cheek as you're leaving, you know, but there must have been some sweet thing that passed between them. And he didn't ignore that.
Yep.
He didn't let the moment, he didn't suppress it. He didn't say, oh, I better not. I feel moved to give this woman a peck on the cheek because she's a dearie, an old dearie, but he didn't suppress it. He did it. And it was one of the last things. She probably died with joy in her heart because of it.
And the poem is titled, What If You Knew? And here's the last. It's a poem of four stanzas. Here's the last stanza. How close does the dragon's spume have to come? How wide does the crack in heaven have to split? What would people look like if we could see them as they are, soaked in honey, stung and swollen, reckless, pinned against time.
Oh. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. You know, if I could write a poem like that, I could die a happy woman.
Right.
I am not a poet. I am a vetter of poems.
You are. Well, you're also a beautiful reader of poems, Kim. I mean, really, this is remarkable. Let me, and your book is just, it's full of this kind of sensitivity to poems and to what they're describing. And you really do make these poems your own. There is something very poetic about how you engage poetry. So you are a poet. Certainly in the way you comment and respond to poems.
I try to open up poetry for people. And when I was, and by the way, your listeners, if anybody loves this idea of a poetry circle, I have them on Zoom and you're more than welcome to come. People come from all over and the conversation is like the conversation you and I are having. It's deeply enriching. But when I was writing, I had two sayings in my writing space. And one was Brenda Yuland, who said, writing is not, you know, like a performance, it's a generosity. Mm. I mean, you know, don't you think most poets come from that place? Because you don't get wealthy being a poet. Nobody becomes a poet because they want to make megabucks. They do it because they have a prophetic spirit, really. And the other one was, come to the page with your heart as open as the heart of God. Come to the page with your heart as open as the heart of God. And wow. that's was one of my guidelines for choosing these poems. Like, where, you know, people who've been through it, who've lived to tell the tale, who've expanded their spirituality because of it. And then they have the talent to wordsmith it for others. And so when we read it, we get that click, that like, that thing in the chest that I can't give words to, that you said before when I read that, I just went, wow. You know, so I was looking for spiritual wow.
Well, that phrase.
Or spiritual sinking, something that makes you sink beneath your ego and your defenses and just be with it.
That phrase, having your heart as open as the heart of God. I mean, that clearly, that kind of thing, that's why, you know, it took you some 4 years to produce this book, Kim, because that kind of thing does not happen with a snap of the fingers. It doesn't happen in 15 minutes. That requires a lot of discipline and a lot of discernment, a lot of time spent listening, which is, in a way, precisely what one tries to do when one companions somebody on a grief journey.
So, well, and remember, I had beautiful support. The two women I dedicated the book to, they were with me the whole way. And my name's on the book. And Sandy Ryder and Ginny Douglas don't get nearly the credit they deserve. And Molly Bolton, who helped vet 1,000 poems. But the crowdsourcing, like, I just feel like Providence, however you understand that, has its fingerprints all over this book. I was terrified. I got this contract at a conference that I went to on poetry and ministry. And I happened to sit next to somebody from Paraclete Press. And when I told them I was leading poetry circles, she said, do you have any poems about grief? Oh. I was like, do I have any poems about grief?
Oh, yeah. Are you kidding? Right. Yeah.
You know, so, and then I was so scared when I handed in the proposal and they took it. And then I'm like, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God. Now I have to write. And my spiritual director of 30 years, who knows me really well, I'm going, oh, my God, you know, in her office. And she like smacked me on the bottom of my boot and goes, how long are we going to keep talking about this? You are the right person to write this book.
Absolutely.
I was like, well, I'm not sure I believe that, but I'm going to lean on your confidence. And that's what I did. So it was not me. I mean, it was me, but you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
It was just Providence all along the way, and people enriched it hugely by their contributions.
It's a beautiful book, Kim. And
thank you, Matt.
Thank you for taking the time to talk with me.
It means so much
today
to me to hear you say that, because it really was a labor of love.
Yeah, well, it shows itself. And I recommend it to not just to those who are grieving, but to anybody who is familiar with the process of grief, or who knows others who grieve, or who just wants to be, wants to enjoy some time thinking about profound things with the beautiful mystery of poetry. So thank you, Kim, for your time. It's been a real delight talking with you.
A pleasure. A total pleasure. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination Podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the BYU Humanities Center and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Abby Thatcher and Bobby May. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips on Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes or would like to know more about the BYU Humanities Center, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.